So this is obviously supposed to be a pretty informal discussion, and I made some selection on some initial topics I wanted to go over.
Did you see what I did? You were here before, right? Everybody knows that. And Fred McIntosh from the pre-university episode, okay. But you were here before I came.
I have officially been here for 2 weeks. I just have had to go away in between. The main thing I wanted to do to start the discussion is go over some very simple ideas about active non-equilibrium fluctuations, but sort of two-thirds of the way into this, I wanted to actually turn it over to Chase. So it's not just going to be me, but we'll try to hold to the, I guess it is basically an hour now for the cookies. So I may not get around to all of this, but as I said, I wanted to talk about active fluctuations, non-equilibrium, obviously. Bring you maybe up to speed, if you're not too familiar with some of the recent developments on this, but to sort of the current state of the art experimentally. It's been very challenging to measure these non-equilibrium fluctuations, especially inside a cell, and there have been some nice developments on this recently that some of you might have heard about if you were at the meeting back in February. So Dave Waits talked about this. I think Christoph talked, Nikta talked about it. And I think you're going to give a talk in maybe in the coming
2 weeks, in, not next week, but the week after.
Yeah, so I won't say too much about those experiments. I'll talk more about some experiments from Dave Waits' group, as well as maybe something from Maria Kilfoyle, who's done some nice stuff on non-equilibrium fluctuations in nuclei. If there's time, I wanted to talk about active remodeling. So the idea here is not just having sort of a stable elastic matrix in which there are active fluctuations, but actually where that activity remodels the matrix itself. And there's some really interesting aspects to this that relate actually to seemingly unrelated things like so-called explosive percolation, if that rings any bell. If it doesn't, I'll try to point out what that is. Then what I would like to end with, explosive percolation? Okay, so in a nutshell, let me actually give an advertisement for this in case I don't actually get around to it. There's been something that has been really I think it's fair to say, essentially purely a theoretical subject. Don't kill me if I'm misstating that, but which is looking at the possibility of having first-order-like percolation transitions, so where you get some radical change with some very small change in parameters, a discontinuous change change in the order parameter. But an amusing thing that came by thinking about some actomyosin experiments, it's a real system worked on by our colleagues across town in Amsterdam, Gijsje Koenderink's group, we've found that there's actually a very simple model that seems to actually be realized, or at least it can help us understand quantitatively those experiments, where you have a first-order-like transition, but with all other signatures of criticality, including diverging correlation lengths and susceptibility. So, well, we'll see whether it was time to get into that. And then there's a much larger subject that I just wanted to try and introduce, and I think Chase is going to talk more about this later, which are so-called marginal or isostatic, actually really sub-isostatic networks. And in particular, looking at, well, first of all, I want to try and argue that this is relevant to thinking about networks, either intracellular networks in cytoskeleton or extracellular matrices. So in fact, one of the motivations here, one of the things that we've been working on most recently is actually looking at implications of this for collagen networks and some longstanding problems in their mechanics. I probably won't get into that, but just try and motivate some interesting aspects of these marginal systems by looking at the effects of thermal fluctuations in them. Okay, so let me start with sort of a very simple-minded picture of what actomyosin networks might look like. And I don't mean in a muscle cell, I mean in a non-muscle cell. So you have some disordered matrix of fibers, and I'll draw some rather suggestive arrangement of these here, such that, so these are actin filaments, and the idea is to look at the effect of myosin, which can bind to multiple filaments and generate relative motion. Myosin is a molecular motor. It happens to be a molecular motor that works in concert or in filaments with a number of them, a number of myosin heads, which, for instance, depending on the polarization of these filaments here, can drive relative motion, relative sliding of these two. And when you do that you can talk about an active fluid, for instance, if these filaments can slide past each other. What I wanted to look at was an active elastic matrix where these are, for instance, cross-linked into some other filaments in the system. And so the result of this would be to generate large contractile stresses here. Now, obviously, at least naively, we're talking about a balanced pair of forces here, at least if these filaments are pulling on individual points within an elastic matrix. And one of the first points to note here is that this is essentially purely tensile. And the reason for this is that if you're, you know, connected to other filaments here, actin basically can't support compressive loads to a first approximation. You have to have a bundle, basically, to support any significant, anything piconewton-ish, let's say, which would be a typical force level. So these filaments here would just buckle immediately, if you like. And so the only real forces, the only relevant forces would be tensile. And that has a number of important implications for networks, of course, actually even their mechanical properties. But I don't want to get into that. But it can actually strongly control the mechanical properties. I think that's something that Chase is going to get into. What I wanted to look at is the resulting time dependence. I want to look at the fluctuations, actually, in these networks these contraction forces generate. But maybe the first thing to do is just point out that one way to model this is to think about a force dipole, a pair of forces separated by some typically large scale, by the way. So these are not point-like dipoles. This scale here, the relevant scale here, could be microns in an in vitro reconstituted system and of order a micron or a couple of microns even in a cell. So the kinds of things that I guess I'll start by talking about some in vitro reconstituted experiments or ideas motivated by some reconstituted experiments actually by Daisuke Masuno a few years ago and Christoph. But the if you imagine that there's just some probe particle in this matrix, and you follow the motion of that particle due to the active fluctuations of many of these force centers. So this is just a typical one. There'll be other ones, or there'll be other ones at other points in the matrix and oriented in different ways, in a disordered matrix at least. So again, a non-muscle cell. And so what you might imagine, I'll draw obviously a 1D picture of this, but I want to argue for a non-1D picture ultimately. But you know, as a function of time, you might imagine that, well, so at some point, this myosin here, this myosin filament, binds to this pair of filaments here, starts generating force. And so you might get something like this. So the force might grow at some point, and then, well, maybe either this filament will fall off, there's a finite time at which this activity occurs, or some other one elsewhere pulls in some other direction. So a very simple-minded way to think about this is that the force itself starts doing a random walk in time. So delta F of t squared, let's say, you might expect to grow linearly in time. Now, obviously, this is a rather strange kind of active force, or strange kind of force fluctuation. You know, if we were talking about thermal forces in a viscous liquid, we would be talking about white noise. This is not going to be white. And then the displacement of a particle might be proportional. The mean square displacement of a particle might be proportional to time. Or if this is truly an elastic matrix, these force fluctuations growing linearly in time like this, mean square force fluctuations growing linearly in time, in an elastic medium would translate to mean square displacements also linear in time. And interestingly, people have observed diffusive-like motion a lot in cells over the years. In many cases, it's actually interpreted to get a diffusion constant and infer a viscosity by treating that diffusive-like motion as thermal, or using a thermal analysis to actually extract a effective viscosity. Obviously, sometimes giving you unphysical results for that viscosity, however. Yeah?
Is there a short-time correlation, a correlation time that below which you don't see the T behavior? I mean, I don't see a very jagged curve in your head.
Oh, yeah. So I'm actually talking about a time scale, a coarse-grained version of this, if you like.
Okay.
Let me say a little bit more about the time regimes as we go on. Ultimately, what's going to happen at short times is, generically in this picture, thermal fluctuations will dominate. So that'll wind up determining the short time behavior typically. And then you'll see this at longer times.
Okay, and what's that number? My question was.
Yeah, so the one thing you might want to start characterizing this little picture here with is something like a characteristic time that motors remain bound. It turns out it really doesn't change, it doesn't really affect things very much in detail if you just basically replace these by step functions, okay? And so then this would, for instance, represent a typical time that a myosin would be bound. That's not apparent in this picture. I'm actually not drawing that correctly. So you have many of these steps occurring because you have multiple motors binding. If you looked at any one of those, so if I could extend this one and isolate this, the effect of this motor, what'll happen is at some long time scale of order seconds, typically, it'll unbind. So I'm actually, this regime here would be less than that, presumably.
So there's a short time scale for the round
yeah.
part,
so there's
and a long time scale for the
yeah.
K part.
Okay. So,
and that time would actually be the sort of the typical binding, it's actually some kind of binding time or some kind of search time or random.
Right. So if you start thinking about the details of this, what you have to worry about, of course, is there'll be on and off rates for the binding. It's, of course, you have to at least bind to two things in order to generate force here.
I didn't mean to derail you. It's not relevant.
No, it turns out not to be so relevant because the really short behavior, I think, is going to be dominated by thermal. Okay. What's much more interesting in the end is going to be the long time, typically of order seconds, that an individual motor maintains a force level. But you're right, this leaving out the details of an actual development of force. So
the thing is this tau is shorter than the single motor correlation time?
Yeah, so
concentration of motors.
So getting a little bit ahead here, but okay. Ultimately what's going to determine these force fluctuations in detail are things like the density of motors, the dwell times or duty ratios of those motors, because at any given time there's only a certain probability that one is doing anything at all. The time scale that they generate force and typically maintain a significant force level, the level of that force step, if you like, so that it'll be of order piconewtons typically. So all those things will ultimately get folded into a more microscopic model that'll actually determine the amplitude of these forces. And so I'll say a little bit about that later. Yeah.
So am I right in understanding that activity can have two competing effects here, meaning one is to sort of, you know, maintain the persistence, I mean, in comparison to this thermal short time fluctuations. And secondly, it can also increase the remodeling.
So hold off on the remodeling a little bit. I actually want to think about the effect of these forces in an absolutely stable elastic system, first of all. Simple, elastic solid, driven by these active forces. Okay, if there's time, I'll say something about remodeling. But yeah, so. Well, you know, ultimately, one thing that's already problematic here, maybe I should point out. Look, if the force fluctuations are really doing a random walk, this is unbounded. Unbounded forces are problematic, right? So I'm either going to start ripping things apart, or what's missing is that no individual motor will retain a coherent exertion of force on the network for an infinitely long time. So that'll cut off this behavior here. So this quantity here would, of course, be, if I start, you know, writing it like this, well, you could relate this mean square force to a force correlation function here. And what you might expect here, if you really just have a simple model of motors binding, having some probability to unbind, then this is actually going to wind up giving you an exponential single characteristic time, which I'll call the processivity time, tau p, which winds up actually being the typical time that an individual motor retains a coherent force in the network. So here's this time here winds up being of order 5 to 10 seconds. So I'll say 10 seconds if you look at realistic systems. So what that means, of course, then is the full behavior of this these force fluctuations here would really look more like this. With some maximum force level, determined by the number density of motors, the duty ratio, and the typical force level of an individual motor. Okay, so the Fourier transform of that, of course, determines a spectrum, a frequency dependence to the force spectrum, which is, of course, going to be a Lorentzian. So you get a Lorentzian force spectrum typically. Now, you can either, a simple phenomenological model that basically says, well, there are forces generated in the network and there's a single characteristic time that governs those, that would and basically lead you to this picture already. A somewhat more microscopic view could actually allow you to estimate numbers, knowing things like, you know, how much force miosins can exert, what their density is, and so on.
But I mean, is there any reason to think that there really is a single characteristic time?
Yeah, so very good question. So I'm going to show you all the experiments point to the answer yes.
But that's not obvious.
It's not obvious. And one reason why I think that's interesting is it's in strong contrast to anything thermal fluctuations are going to do. So what would thermal in this picture be? Actually, I should draw this bigger. So let me redraw it. Okay, so here's the expectation for the active fluctuations. And what thermal would be, well, okay, so you might be tempted to put a flat line here for white noise, but of course that's inconsistent with a viscoelastic medium. The fluctuation dissipation theorem forces even the thermal fluctuations to be colored. And so I need to tell you something about the frequency-dependent response in these materials. So if you look at the frequency-dependent shear modulus, for instance, so that'll determine, let's say, what the resistance is that a particle will feel. Typically what happens is you have weak power law behaviors here. So they're nearly elastic, but not quite. And this exponent here, it'll typically be in the range of about a tenth to a 0.2. And so what that means for the thermal fluctuations is they're colored noise with a slope, which is beta minus 1. So in other words, it'll be almost minus 1 slope. And so what that immediately starts to suggest is you should expect to see generally at least two characteristic timescales for the system.
So is the frequency range you've used, basically, is it exactly the same range as in the experiments?
So the experiments I wanted to mention.
Really a high frequency measurement.
Okay, so this is a tenth of a hertz. So that would be this range here would be easily coverable by video, I guess, would be sort of down here. You probably can't reach this with video, normal video. But it's not hard to reach that regime, it turns out, with, you know, slightly high-speed cameras, let's say. So typically what will happen...
Normal microrheology is down there. So
that's normal what?
Active rheology. I mean, what you do with tweezers and things.
No, that's much higher.
It's not at all hard to get up to kilohertz.
Okay, so kilohertz for you is over there.
Yeah.
Maybe 100 hertz, rather, right?
Well, so this crossover, what's your best number, Nikta, from your systems, 100 hertz?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what you can get is something like two orders of magnitude here, typically, at least. Obviously, you could also have another situation where this curve lies above, in which case active is never going to dominate. So I'm only drawing the interesting case, which does turn out to be quite relevant for the experiments I'll talk about. But the important thing to note here is that there's at least two characteristic timescales you might see as a result in some experiment. One of them is going to be determined by a microscopic parameter that has to do with the motor activity, and the other one is simply going to be determined by a relative amplitude of two things. So it's not, if you like, a some fundamental time scale about what the motors are doing, let's say. And to get back to your question earlier, I mean, I think typically this is going to happen before you get to a regime where some sort of interesting high frequency aspects of the motor activity come in. That's one reason why I'll leave that out.
I mean, what I have in mind really is whether there's a role for number fluctuations, and I've not seen that in any of the theories. And that
number fluctuations
could give you power laws that are anomalous, something like that. So T to the 3/2 type behavior. But okay, that's maybe a theoretical fantasy.
Maybe we should talk about that later. But you will see this. You know, if you go down to a regime where you have low density of motors, let's say, and somehow, let's say, okay, so that's going to reduce this amplitude, okay? So let's say somehow some system that doesn't become thermal dominated. So if I could ignore this yellow bit, then you might imagine if you somehow suppress the motor activity, you're going to see more number fluctuations. If you look at the consequences of that, what you'll find is, in the ensemble sense, this picture still holds. What you'll just see would be more, let's say, sample to sample, you know, point to point variations within the sample.
Is it not possible to change the exponent? I thought it would be.
No.
Because number fluctuations are hierarchical. They have this Poisson.
By the way, this derivation assumes a Poisson distribution for this motor activity. What it also assumes, I should probably say, is independent motor binding and unbinding. So one thing that could start changing this picture substantially, but I'm not aware of any experimental evidence to suggest that this happens, but it is something to bear in mind, is that, so for instance, myosin is known to be a rather strange, bind rather strangely. It's a so-called catch bond. Some of them are. So when it goes under load, when you load the myosin hard, it actually can, it will typically reduce its off rate. Okay? Now what that means is some other motor elsewhere in the system could pull on the system and affect the kinetics of this one. And this picture I just went through will break down because I'll get genuine cooperative behavior among the motors.
Experiments, it was a Christoph's experiment showed that if you have a bead in a network like this, then the fluctuations of the bead are actually not Gaussian, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that what you'd expect based on this picture?
Actually, I think this picture, I guess I don't quite see how non-Gaussian fluctuations come out of it, but we shouldn't be surprised because they're non-equilibrium. But I guess
it's
Some
are close and some are far away.
That's sort of like Ramin's question about number fluctuations. If you get to the point where you get small numbers involved, I guess what I'm talking about is an ensemble The motor activity you see is a good reflection of an ensemble average. That is an assumption I'm making.
If we're going to start talking about Christoph's experiment, something which I don't understand is whether the traces that you're looking at actually move and then stay moved, or whether when the elastic network jumps back, the traces move back with them.
They move back with the
cross-linked. In the strongly cross-linked case, we have lots of cross-links, and we have dice with all the experiments. So pretty much everything moves back to where it came from. But
yeah,
of course, it's always moving, but it doesn't go anywhere on average.
Right, so you can't model this as a random walk then.
Sorry?
You can't model this as a random walk.
Yeah, actually, I think you're raising an interesting point. So I'm, okay, so if you look at what a typical position of one particular probe bead does as a function of time, what you'll see is things like this, where this would be the result of some motor binding and pulling it, some significant amount, and then releasing. I do not claim that this can be described by that ensemble. What I do claim is that if you see many of these events and average over them, then this picture is valid.
Why? Why when you suddenly start averaging, does it make a difference?
Well, so this, as you pointed out, is not well described by a random walk of the force acting on the particle. Is that what you were worried about?
No, I'm just worried about, yeah, I'm worried about the fact that this particle, if it was doing a random walk, the force would act on it and it would move from one place to the next, like this. Whereas it seems like because of the elasticity of the network, every time it moves, it moves back to where it was before.
Well, so the force is bounded. And so if you look averaged over time, there is a typical position of the particle, which is its rest position. So its motion is not unbounded. So the particle will tend to return to its rest position.
Yeah.
It's the force that I'm saying is doing a random walk up to some bounded level. So in an elastic medium, that would correspond to the position also following that. So the mean square displacement would look like that as well.
No.
But it's bounded.
But then the position's got to go back to zero, basically, as the force turns off. It hasn't got to increase with time. Because every time the motor detaches, the effect of that motor will turn.
Oh, okay. This picture here, so if I replace this with a mean square displacement that has the same form, that's not inconsistent with this picture.
So the mean square displacement saturates.
If the mean square displacement saturates,
then
if I look at
that, yes.
Yeah, if I look at, and I claim that that sort of has to be the case because otherwise the forces are going to be unbounded. If the mean square displacement is bounded, and if I just look at the average position of a particle over time, mm-hmm. it will have a well-defined average. So if I see many of these events, you know, some other one will do something like this, or maybe for some longer time even, and then, you know, come back. Sorry, terrible drawing. I don't see the problem. This is not diffusion. The particle has bounded motion,
yeah.
So it will have a well-defined average position.
Which will be zero.
It's rest.
But x squared can have a value, yes. But x has to be zero.
X average is zero. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Sorry, this is taking way longer than I meant. So let me just wrap this up and talk about some recent experiments, and then turn it over to, basically, I'll skip this bit here. Let me just finish with the experiments and then try to motivate why sub-isostatic systems are interesting. So what did the experiments observe? The experiments I mentioned before that motivated some of these more sort of microscopic picture of force fluctuations were done in a in vitro reconstituted system, a well-controlled actomyosin network. It's been very challenging to reproduce that kind of an experiment in a living cell. So one example in that direction is something Deiske and Christoph did, which was to look at motion outside of a cell on the exterior. But the first experiments I'm aware of to actually do the same kind of experiment inside a cell were by Ming Guo in Dave Waite's lab. So the idea was to inject probe particles of basically 200 nanometers to 500 nanometers inside a living cell. It cost seven cell in particular, and to measure both the fluctuations of position of particles, so basically to track things like a mean square displacement of the particle, but also to measure, and this is crucial, what they could directly measure was the mechanical response of the surrounding media. And the nice thing about that is it allows you to directly measure the force spectrum, which of course would then just be, I'll put in a proportionality here. Obviously, this shear modulus will determine an effective spring constant that that probe particle sees. And so what you can do, I'll write this. This is shear modulus. What you can do is go from the position fluctuations together with directly measured mechanical response to actually determine directly what the force fluctuations are. So doing particle tracking is never enough, because you need an independent measure of the mechanics of the network in order to extract the forces. And so what they observe, I'd be happy to show you the real experiments if you want, but I'll just sketch this. It's actually that. So what they observe is something like this. So their measured force fluctuations show a beautiful Lorentzian form. You can actually infer also this processivity time from those experiments. It winds up being consistent with what you expect for actomyosin. Typically more like 5 seconds in those experiments. Furthermore, at high frequencies, this was completely consistent with the expected thermal spectrum for the measured mechanical response. And what they could do was introduce blebbistatin. It's a drug which suppresses myosin activity. And it basically just showed a parallel translation of this, and then saturation to what was interpreted as a thermal response at an earlier time. Again, showing that this crossover here is not really a fundamental characteristic time for motor activity, just a measure essentially of how much motor activity you have. So this is this was with blebbistatin suppressing the motor activity. And again, this is it's the force spectrum. And even, this is slightly dangerous, but they even did an ATP depletion. Now, depleting ATP makes the cell unhappy in many ways. But at least for some short period of time when they could do the experiments, they actually recovered the thermal spectrum. So it was actually consistent with basically just suppressing entirely this active response or active force fluctuations. Interestingly, blebbistatin and other drugs are frequently discussed as a sort of knockout, a sort of a chemical intervention which suppresses, in this case, motor activity, but it's only partial. So you can never get more than roughly a factor of 10 suppression of the motor activity.
The system is marginally stable, or the central force threshold where